All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our allergies teleclass, Independence and Safety in the Outside World. For those of you new to our teleclass series or who don't already know me, my name is Jennifer Rojas, and I'm the blog editor and operations director for Mommy Bites. For those of you who are new to our format, you're all muted right now, so you don't need to worry about any background noise. Because of the popularity of the class that we're on, we've decided to hold any questions till the end. However, if you'd like to ask a question, please feel free to type it in. It's super easy. You'll see on your event landing page in the top left corner, there is an Ask a Question button. So you can simply click on Ask a Question and a box will pop up for you to type in your question and you can submit it. So I'll be monitoring those throughout. But again, we've decided we'll actually address those questions at the end of the class. And you can ask as many questions as you want. So, and you can put your name in or you can leave it entirely anonymous. So just feel free to ask questions and we will get to them. So we're really excited about this teleclass today. I first want to talk about our expert, Robin O'Brien. She's fabulous, and I can't wait for you to hear from her. Before we jump in, I want to give a huge shout out to our sponsor today. Our sponsor is Happy Family, and they were launched in, wow, it's 10 years ago, 2006. Happy Family Organic Foods are inspired by moms and developed with pediatricians and nutritionists to provide your family with the most delicious and nutritious foods possible. Their goal is to make every bite count. So they are dedicated to creating nutrient-rich foods for the first 1,000 days. And if you're not sure what that means, that's your child's most important growth and development period and a time when their taste preferences are evolving. So Happy Family is the real deal. They're really here to help support a lifetime of healthy eating. So as I mentioned, we have an amazing expert today. Her name is Robin O'Brien, and she has actually been called Food's Erin Brockovich by Bloomberg and the New York Times. She's a food industry analyst, author, and mother of four, and she's regularly featured in the media for her insights. So welcome, Robin. We're really excited to have you with us today. And can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to be doing this really important work?
Well, absolutely. And thank you so much for having me. And a huge thank you to Happy Family. It's pretty special to actually be working with Happy Family on this today because I first met the founders the year that they launched. So I've known this company since its very, very beginning. And to watch what it's become, to watch the incredible service that it provides to countless families around the country. I'm so proud of the work that they do. I'm so proud of the products that they help give families. So it really is so much fun to continue to work with this brand because we've been partners for such a long time. So thank you to Happy Family for hosting this. And yes, in a million years, no, I never thought I would be doing something like this. I grew up in Texas and wasn't a foodie. And really had no sensitivity to the food allergy space. You know, it wasn't a condition that many of us knew as kids. And so when moms first started talking about this, you know, 10, 12 years ago, I was not very sensitive to it. And I just thought, since when? You know, how come so many kids now have food allergies and is this really real or are these moms just kind of trying to create an issue? And there was not really a conversation around food allergies. There was not an education around it. None of us had really been taught how pervasive it had become. So it just seemed to sort of come from out of the blue. And I wasn't that sensitive to it. And then our fourth child had this allergic reaction. And so here I was, totally clueless, totally illiterate, not a foodie, getting handed this diagnosis of food allergies for our fourth child, and all I could think was, how am I going to do my job as a mom? How in the world am I going to protect the health of this child if she is allergic to food? It seemed impossible to comprehend, that moment of just really sheer terror of how in the world am I going to navigate this? And for us in those early years, you know, I was just a busy mom and I'd get all the groceries at Costco and I didn't think about it and I figured if it was on the shelves, it was safe and I hadn't really given any attention to the organic thing, you know, and yet in that moment, all of a sudden my whole world changed because I had to start reading these labels. And as I started reading food labels, it was in that I realized how little I actually knew. And as you start to turn over the side of a box or, you know, the side of a jar, you realize that there are so many ingredients that are put into our food supply today that weren't there several years ago, weren't there even 10 or 15 years ago. And then you don't even really know what they are, you know. And as I was looking at food allergies, so many of these different food allergies, whether it was egg or milk, they came with different terms. And so there were a lot of different ways that they could be labeled using this different vocabulary and this different terminology. And, you know, here I had gone to business school on a full scholarship. I had covered the food industry on a team that managed $20 billion in assets, and I was totally clueless. And that was such an incredibly humbling experience, to be in a place where you do not feel equipped to protect the health of your own child. It's a horrible feeling as a mother. And so I just absolutely went at it with everything that I am to try to understand not only this condition of food allergies and why it was starting to impact so many kids, but also, you know, what could I do as a mother of four in my own home with four small children that could not read? How could I protect the health of that baby? And what could I do to protect her in, you know, daycare situations, in the nursery at church, in the community with grandparents? No one would ever intend to cause harm, but how could I protect my baby? And it really began a lifetime of work. And in the early years, it was really very food allergy focused. But as I started to learn more and more about the food system and about the additives and about all these additional ingredients that were getting pumped into our food, it expanded the scope of the work to really bring to light not only that food allergies were a condition that our children were dealing with, but there were so many other conditions that were now impacting our kids. And in a lot of cases, food allergies can go hand in hand with something like asthma. Food allergies can go hand in hand with autism. Food allergies can go hand in hand with eczema. And I realized that the conversation was a really big one and a really important one to have.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing about your journey. Listening to you speak, the words scary and daunting really came to mind, but yet ultimately empowering. So really, that's an incredible journey that you've been on. And our attendees here are going to have the benefit of all of the stuff that you had to learn, which is amazing. So to get the flow of the class going, I'll do some Q&A with Robin to get us started and lay the groundwork. And again, feel free to type in any questions you might have along the way, and we will eventually address them. So let's get right into it. Robin, can you explain, it's a simple question, but can you please explain what is a food allergy?
It's a great question. And 10 years ago when my daughter was first diagnosed, I didn't know. You know, it's all of a sudden you're hearing about these kids that are allergic to peanuts or milk or wheat or soy. You know, what is a food allergy? And a food allergy is when your body sees a food protein as foreign. And so it doesn't recognize it. Your body won't recognize it. And so it launches this inflammatory response to drive out that foreign invader. And I think of like the Star Wars guys with their lightsabers. You know, your body goes into that kind of fight mode to drive out that foreign invader. And in some cases, that can be a runny nose or itchy skin or watery eyes. But in some life-threatening cases, the body systems begin to shut down. And anaphylaxis can occur, and that is where you lose your ability to breathe and you lose your ability to regulate your body and your throat closes. And in some cases, in extreme cases, that can result in death. And the issue with food allergies is every person, every child is different on that scale, on that spectrum, that no two reactions can be the same. A child may be fine, have minor reaction, and then the next exposure, it might be a lot more serious. And it's the unpredictability in food allergies which can make them particularly terrifying. It's also the unpredictability that really mandates that as parents and caregivers, that we are as well-equipped and as well-informed as we can possibly be at all times to help manage this condition. And so, you know, it can be one of those things where your child starts to have difficulty breathing or difficulty swallowing, or maybe their eyes get watery. And in a lot of cases, there can be a hesitation like, oh, should we just sort of wait this out? let's just see what this what can happen. But if your child has been diagnosed with a food allergy and you have those epinephrines on hand, the EpiPens are on hand, the doctors will always encourage you to go for that first and call 911. There are too many stories in the 10 years of this work that I have heard of parents who delayed on giving the EpiPen and regret it with everything that they are. So to always be armed with the Benadryl, with the EpiPen, to always be prepared, to make sure that those medications are always available in your child's school, in their preschool, in their nursery, in their daycare center. Those are the kinds of things that we as a generation of parents are accepting as our responsibility. And does it stink? Yes, totally. It is a responsibility that no one would choose. No one would choose this condition for their child, but it is a responsibility that we now have as parents, because if you look at the exploding number of children with food allergies today, it's two kids in every classroom. It's, you know, there's a 2011 study that said it was 1 in 13 kids. Last year there was another study that came out that said it was 1 in 10 kids. From 1997 to 2007, the rate of hospitalizations related to food allergic reactions increased 265%. So there's no need to apologize for it anymore. There's no need to feel any type of guilt, any type of shame. This is a condition that has come on so hard and so fast for 21st century families. And the silver lining in that is that you will find an ally. You will find another parent who is dealing with this condition like you are, and then you can go shoulder to shoulder, arm in arm, and really work to create some solutions.
Wow. So that is really actually very sobering, and yet with a bit of hope there. And so, you know, continuing on with the sobering aspect of this condition, you cited some incredibly alarming statistics. Can you shed a bit of light on those numbers?
Absolutely. You know, and I think the data, to me, you know, I'm a finance person. That's what I always thought I would do. I didn't expect to not go back to finance after I had the kids, but I left it behind because I don't think there's anything more important than protecting the health of our children, because it is the future of our country. And as I left finance behind, I didn't ever lose those skills. And as you look at the data, you know, whether you look at 1 in 10 or 1 in 13 kids now with a food allergy, that 265% increase in the rate of hospitalizations related to food allergies, or that a life-threatening allergic reaction sends somebody to the emergency room once every 6 minutes in the United States. I mean, those are jaw-dropping numbers. This is not a condition that is slowing down. It's not a condition that's going away. And I think probably the biggest data point that speaks to that is this company EpiPen that makes these auto-injectors, this epinephrine that is a life-saving device. Back in 2007, that was a $200 million brand. Today, EpiPen is a billion-dollar brand. The other billion-dollar brands that people might know is something like Cheerios. So this thing is legit. It's really happening. And what we're seeing now are, you know, whether we're talking about the airline industry, whether we're talking about schools, whether we're talking about access, whether we're talking about 75% of schools in Canada are now nut-free, you know, what we're doing as a generation is, how do we wrap our heads around this, and how do we create a safe environment for all these kids?
Thank you for that. And again, it's really alarming. And there's something that you sort of referenced a little bit, which was, you know, that parents shouldn't apologize for anything, that this is a real issue. And it sounds like there was a little bit over time of kind of people, you know, discounting moms when these things were starting to happen. So what that says to me is that something has changed. I mean, can you give us an idea of, you know, when did things start to change? Because I think when we were kids, or our parents were kids, or our grandparents, nobody talked about food allergy. So when did this all start?
You know, I think it was in the 1990s. I mean, you look at the data from the 1990s and the 265% increase in the rate of hospitalizations. You know, it was mid-1990s when all of a sudden this condition took off. And in the early years of my work, no one wanted to believe it, because it really, like, to suddenly have a generation that's allergic to food, it's really tough to absorb that. You know, it's really tough to acknowledge how big of an impact that's going to have on everything from, you know, a family at home to the cafeteria at school. And so there was real pushback in the early years as these children began to present. And no one wanted to take it seriously. You know, even the science was saying, well, if a child has a food allergy, they just have one food allergy. So some of the leading allergists were even saying, it's impossible for a child to have multiple food allergies. Well, if you go out to most families today, rarely is the child dealing with just one. Usually you'll find sort of a cluster of different allergies and sensitivities and things that a child will react to. And so what was part of my work in the early years was, how do I create that place where the mom feels safe to come in and talk about this, where she knows that there's somebody who has the courage to be on the front line talking about this, that, you know, yes, there were going to be tons of people dismissing us, and yes, there were going to be tons of people rolling their eyes, or, you know, sometimes even family members don't even understand. I've heard from so many families where they say the grandparents don't even understand, and it's because they weren't dealing with it. So they can't understand what they didn't know. And what we have, the task in front of us, I think, as a generation, is to really educate and create an environment that's safe for these kids. And so, you know, in the last 10 years, it really has been fascinating to see it take its place as a condition that needs to be taken seriously. And I think, you know, parallels are in the diabetic community, and you have all of these children now that are dealing with different levels of diabetes, and food allergies are it's a similar mindset where you've, like, this tiny amount of food could trigger a life-threatening reaction in a child. And I truly believe now, 10 years into this work, that food allergies have finally arrived on that stage as a condition that is legitimate. People are not making it up. You have actresses, you know, that are incredibly famous speaking out on this. You have incredibly famous businessmen. And there are enough of us now speaking to the issue to say, this is real, this is serious, so how are we going to protect the health of these kids? And I think just this year alone, probably one of the most inspiring examples of the legitimacy that was bestowed on the condition was at the Empire State Building during Food Allergy Awareness Week, which is in May, lit up teal, which is the food allergy color, mm-hmm. and Niagara Falls went teal, and again, it was really kind of a big national global recognition of this condition. Wow. And the fact that it's now impacting so many kids.
Amazing. And is it because of what's in the food, or were there food allergies all along and people just didn't know this? Is it
there are going to be a ton of different theories out there. And 10 years ago when I was first starting into it, that was a theory of the hygiene hypothesis. And, you know, kind of it conjured up this image that moms were just all frantically Purelling their hands and their kids' mm-hmm. hands, and the kids weren't exposed to dirt, and we didn't grow up on the farm. And I think that's one way to look at this. I think this has come on so hard and so quickly that we really need to step back and say, okay, let's examine all of the different environmental triggers that could be happening here. And if you're going to say that it's the antibacterial cleanser that, you know, and it's the fact that we've over sanitized everything, you also have to look at how we're treating our meat with chlorine and how we're treating our meat with all these antibiotics. You have to look at the entire system that our child is exposed to environmentally. You have to look at food, I think, is a huge component of it. There are different people that are addressing different industries, looking into different impacts. Me, with my background in food, I stay focused on food. There are other people that will focus on other industries, but for me, my focus is 100% on food because that's my background and that's the depth of my experience. And as I really started diving into the food, you realize that our food now is so loaded with so many things, you know, whether it's chicken that's been treated with chlorine or whether it's salmon that's been injected with red food coloring, you know, what we wow. think we're getting in the food, we're getting all this other stuff too. And so it gets back to that question, are we allergic to the food or are we allergic to what's been done to it? And this condition has mm-hmm. come on hard and quickly. And it's not that we're over-diagnosing it now, not when you look at things like, you know, hospitalizations related to food allergic reactions. That is people getting checked into the ER because of this condition. It's not a mom self-diagnosing a kid. So, you know, you look at the food, you look at the record levels of things like pesticides are being applied to so many of the things. You look at the record levels of food coloring that's going in. You look at the artificial growth hormones that are going into the dairy. And again, it just begs the question, you know, have we hit a tipping point with these additives where a child's system literally rejects the food?
Wow. Thank you. These are really important questions to explore. So a while back you had mentioned that, you know, a child might be showing some kind of signs like a runny nose or something really simple all the way to the extreme end of the spectrum where they literally can't breathe. So can you explain some of the signs of food allergies so that moms can understand what to look for?
Absolutely. And, you know, on my website, robinobryan.com, I have an article up right now that is specifically for this, and it speaks to food allergies and food sensitivities. And the food allergy tends to be an immediate reaction, you know, something where it's like you consume it, you can see the reaction right away, whether your child suddenly breaks out in hives or suddenly, you know, develops a rash all over the skin. We had, you know, one of our girls consumed a hazelnut and just her skin blistered just immediately, and it lasted for probably 48 hours. And again, the difficulty in managing this condition is that it is so unpredictable, and it is so hard to say there's one size fits all when there really isn't. So you really have to learn how to read the clues and read your child's body as they are consuming these different things. So the common symptoms of a food allergy, which is the immediate reaction, you know, can be this rash or hives, nausea, stomach pain, diarrhea, itchy skin, eczema, a shortness of breath, a chest pain, and then when it gets really severe, it's the swelling of the airways to the lungs and anaphylaxis, which is that life-threatening reaction where they lose the ability to breathe. And then the food sensitivities, again, those can be delayed, and that can appear, you know, even over a couple of days, and that can be fatigue, stomach bloating, gas, itchy skin and eczema, again, kind of a brain fog, joint aches or muscle aches and pains, like if your kid's complaining about like sore legs or sore arms, a headache, and, you know, you can see things like dark circles under the eyes. And so those are much harder to pin down because that could just be a sleepless night. That could be a lot of different things. But again, when you realize that, like, a child maybe has difficulty breathing or chronic skin conditions, what parents are realizing is, you know, a lot of times that can be an underlying allergy that hasn't been diagnosed. So if your child is presenting with eczema all the time, and this was the case with one of our older children before our youngest had this reaction, you know, we were treating this kid with all these eczema creams over and over and over again. And it wasn't until after our youngest was diagnosed with food allergies that we realized that this older boy had a milk issue. And as soon as we got dairy out of his diet, his skin issues disappeared.
Amazing.
So the more that we can educate each other, the more that you can work with both your pediatrician and your allergist, the faster you can get to the bottom of what is causing it. You know, what is that trigger?
This is great. And it sounds like you have a ton of resources on your website. So attendees, we will be sending out a follow-up email within the next few days, and it will provide you with Robin's contact information and additional resources so that, you know, don't worry about needing to take notes or anything like that. This is just such important stuff. So we will make sure that you have ongoing access to this information. So, I mean, given the how scary this all is and how real these allergies are, and you're talking about specifically with food, the chemicals that are being put in food, and just in general, sometimes people don't even know what to look for. So in reality, how can people create a safe home environment?
You know, that's such a great question, and it totally takes me back to the gut-wrenching moment of being in my own kitchen and realizing with these four small children, nobody could read the labels. And that, you know, could they accidentally kill their baby sister without meaning to and not knowing? And, you know, her first reaction was to egg. And you think about how pervasive things like eggs are, how pervasive things like milk are, butter, you know, things like that that are just in things you take for granted. And I had this moment of, how do I keep this child safe? And it was terrifying. And, you know, in the early years of my work, when we launched Allergy Kids, we actually designed a logo. And it was to really help identify the kids' foods. And so that, you know, a little kid that couldn't read would know, yes, this is safe to give to my sister. No, it's not. And I would highly recommend something like that. You've got to educate the whole family, including relatives, including grandparents, to create that safe home environment. And a lot of families, what they'll do is they'll just have a designated cupboard or a designated shelf in the fridge that is 100% designated, you know, for the food allergic family member. You know, the next level up is to try not to bring those things into the home. And in the early years for us, I really was pretty strident on that. You know, I was really careful about what we allowed into the home. And in the early years, it was pretty isolating because we didn't eat out a whole lot. You know, we really had to safeguard our kid. But I think it was also we had to get up to speed on the condition, and we had to know what we could do, what we were comfortable with. And there was so much fear in the beginning. And so
sure.
And to really just remind people, that's really normal. And the reason you're so afraid is because you love so much. So once you get through the fear and you get to that love, that's the rocket fuel. And once you tap into that, that's the power. That's going to give you the strength. That's going to give you the courage to really go out and be proactive and do what you need to do to protect your kid. But in the early years, it was we really tried to minimize any opportunities for exposure. So we reduced what we brought into the house. And then I just went totally deep on learning everything I could about food. And, you know, learning about the different ways that eggs are made and why are some cage-free and why are some, you know, grass-fed, like what's going on here, and to really try to understand as much as I could about food production. And the further I went down that path, the more I realized how many additives, how many preservatives, things like genetically engineered ingredients, all the pesticides that go with them, how all these things had gone into our food, and we didn't really know. And I thought, you know, if I had known that that was on my kitchen table along with the food, if I knew that there was a spray can of Roundup right next to it, and if I knew that there was this artificial, you know, yellow number 5, and I knew that there were all these things that literally had zero nutritional benefit, would I choose them? And I realized I wouldn't. And so as I began to understand how to avoid all these additives and these synthetic pesticides and these chemicals and everything, it kept coming back to organic. And at the time, you know, as a mother of four, I just thought, that's like a loaded word and it's crazy expensive and I'm not sure I want to go that route. And what I realized is that if something carries that symbol, USDA organic, if something carries that seal, it's a legal standard. And by law, it means that those foods do not allow the synthetic toxic pesticides. They do not allow the GMOs. They do not allow the artificial dyes. They do not allow the artificial growth hormones. They do not allow all of these additives that have been introduced in the last 20 years. And so for me, that was a way to exercise precaution. And as I looked at it, I realized, you know, in the U.S., we had to give this adjective organic to describe food, whereas in other countries, in 64 countries around the world, they had labeled the genetically engineered ingredients. They were labeling the new stuff, you know, whereas we had to kind of come up with a word to label the food that had appeared in its original form.
Wow. So can you just repeat for the audience again, really quickly, what it is that they should look for? What is that stamp? Because I have heard and I've read a lot about companies put, you know, they label their foods organic, but they're maybe not actually organic. So tell us again, what is that official seal that we should be looking for?
That is such a great question. And I have an article that I will often repeat on my website to sort of bring it back up to the surface about organic. What does it mean? Is it worth it? Where is it worth it? And if something carries that USDA organic seal, that is a legal standard by law. And there is such an accountability to that system. There are audits that can be conducted. There are fees that are paid. It's a legal standard, which means by law, those products are produced with organic ingredients. There's a lot of sort of gray. You know, you'll see products that will say made with organic ingredients or 70% organic. It's not the same as that legal seal that says USDA organic. And it can either be green and white or it can be black and white. But it is a legal seal, and there is a whole accountability behind that. So that's the gold standard right now. And then beyond that, you know, you're starting to see different verifications. You see like a gluten-free verification, which means that parts per billion are either included or not included if something is labeled gluten-free. You see things like the non-GMO project, which is a certification that the number of genetically engineered ingredients in that product fall below a certain threshold. In the non-GMO project, that threshold is the same as countries around the world, what they don't allow. So that standard is like Europe's standard. But really that USDA organic seal is sort of the gold standard. And it just means by law that GMOs aren't allowed, pesticides, synthetic pesticides aren't allowed, artificial dyes, artificial growth hormones, crazy sounding things like sewage sludge, which I was learning all of this, I was like, I didn't know sewage sludge was going into everything, and it is. And the only way you can make sure that it's not is through that USDA organic seal. And so as I was learning that, you know, I thought, this should be the gold standard for everybody. This shouldn't be a lifestyle, the rich and famous thing. This shouldn't be a zip code thing. Truly, that should be the standard that if any American family wants to buy organic, it should be the affordable option. And that really is going to require years of work where we restructure sort of the funding around farming in the United States, because right now the organic farming sector does not get the same financial support as the chemically intensive sector gets. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the lifetime of work that's in front of me. But it's also, I just think, incredibly inspiring right now to watch what's happening, because as consumers demand more organic, and it's just off the charts, 78% of families now are looking for at least some organic. As consumers demand that organic food, the food industry is responding, and they're saying, you know what, we don't have the supply chain here in the United States. Less than 1% of our farmland is organic. And so what they're doing is they're creating it themselves. So you see a General Mills, which just announced a partnership with Organic Valley. They've just announced that they're going to convert conventional farmland for dairy to organic farmland for dairy. So that'll help offer more organic yogurt, more organic milk. Costco, they just announced that they're doing the same thing. Kashi, the cereal company, they're doing the same thing. And those stories to me are so inspiring, because nobody's sitting there waiting for somebody else to take action. Nobody's sitting there saying, oh, our government, they should have done it. You know, we should have changed this. But these companies are leading, and they are 100% responding to consumer demand, and that to me is just so inspiring.
That is really excellent, and thank you so much for that information. I have to say, you probably can't tell because we're on the phone, but if you don't know me, I'm actually 5,000 miles away from all of you right now, around 5,000 miles away. I live in a different country. And when I come back, I've been coming back to visit the States for about 6 years, off and on. And I feel like every time I've come back for a visit and I go even to a mainstream supermarket, I'm noticing more and more and more options, more organic, more gluten-free, particularly this past time. I was back in the States just a few months ago, and I was really like pleasantly surprised and overwhelmed at how many options there were now. I mean, it sounds like there's still a long way to go, but it sounds like there's progress being made, or I've seen it. So Robin, we talked about how to create a safe home environment. But what about, I mean, kids are out going on play dates, you know, you can't keep your kids from, you know, going outside the four walls. So how can people protect their children from the outside world?
I think you have to raise them up strong. You can't shy away from these hard conversations. These kids are so inspiring. They are so strong. They understand that this their condition just the way a kid with diabetes understands that too. And you teach them that they always have their medical device with them. You teach them to ask. You teach them to advocate for themselves. And as any parent knows, I mean, kids are sponges. They will absolutely take in what you give them. And the more that that just becomes part of their upbringing, you know, you teach a child to take care of themselves by brushing their teeth. You teach them to take care of themselves by putting a helmet on when they ride their bike. When you have a child with food allergies, you just teach them to take care of themselves that same way. And it's who they are. Their friends know that it's who they are. And what I think is so inspiring is the way in a classroom, in an elementary school or somewhere, the kids are just so sensitive to those special needs of their classmates. And, you know, we'll have one of the kids will come home and say, it's my birthday and I'm taking something in, but it can't have nuts, and I want to make sure that Rafe or whoever the kid is can be part of this. And these kids, you know, it's all they've known. It's all they've ever known is that they have these classmates with food allergies, and there's a sensitivity there, there's an acceptance there that we didn't have in our generation. You know, they're not going to roll their eyes because it's all they've known. They've always known a classmate to have a food allergy. So have them be their own best advocate. And I think, you know, the challenges change as they grow up. They change as they become teenagers, and they don't want to always have their EpiPen with them. But again, it's just to remind them that, you know, when they get in the car, they buckle their seatbelt. When they head out the door, they take their EpiPen.
Thank you. So teaching them, educating them, having them be empowered. So do you have any tips on how to teach children and their siblings how to protect themselves along the way?
No, there are so many different resources, and thankfully now, you know, there's so many children's books that friends have written. You know, in the 10 years of this work, I've heard from countless authors who are usually mothers, who usually have a child with food allergies, who've written books. And, you know, we're starting to see food allergies more in mainstream media. I remember taking the kids to see the movie Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, and, you know, there was one of the lead characters had a peanut allergy. It's becoming much more a part of the conversation, and I think the resources are just exploding. And whether you have the resources in a company like Happy Family, another brand that does an amazing job, is Late July, and that's because the founder of that company, Nicole, who is also a friend of ours and a friend of Happy Family, she has a child with peanut allergy. So these brands are doing an amazing job of advocating to and offering resources to. But really, you know, there are amazing resources online. They're making short videos that you can share. I know that the manufacturers of EpiPen have just come out with a series of videos. And some terrifying, and I think it's a balance there of you don't want to terrify your child into isolation. And I have heard from families where, you know, the child becomes so terrified they don't want to go out. So it's a very important role as a parent, you know, to have the conversation, to open the conversation, to keep the child talking, to keep that child asking questions, to get in on the resources together. And, you know, again, just to parallel it to putting on a helmet when you ride a bike or putting on the seatbelt when you get in the car, it's just a precaution. And it doesn't mean every time you're on your bike you're going to have an accident, or every time you're in the car you're going to, you know, get in a wreck, but it's just a precaution. And I think to frame it that way and really empower the children and the family members is probably the most important thing.
Okay, thank you for that. So switching gears a little bit here, and going back a bit, you know, we've talked about some of the crazy things that are actually in our food. I mean, I knew there was some crazy stuff, but not until just now during this call did I realize just how horrible some of the things that are going into our foods. Is this specifically a United States problem? I mean, is food different in the U.S.? And if so, how is it different in the U.S. than other countries?
Yeah, you know, that is a really great question. And unfortunately, it is higher in the U.S. Different countries have food allergies. And for example, like in the U.K., celery is a more pervasive allergy. You know, things like mustard can be an allergy. Here, you know, the top eight tend to be soy, wheat, dairy, nuts, tree nuts, fish, shellfish. And unfortunately, you know, there really have been these studies recently out of Northwestern Chicago that living in the United States raises the risks of food allergies. And when you step back and you say, okay, what's going on? Children born outside the United States had significantly lower prevalence of any allergic disease, right around 20%, versus those that are born in the United States, which is close to 35%. And this was a study led by Jonathan Silverberg of St. Luke's Roosevelt's Hospital Center in New York. And so, you know, you really have to step back and say, you know, what is going on here and how can we protect our children? How can we reduce their exposure to all this artificial stuff? How can we reduce their exposure to all of this stimulation? And, you know, thankfully, the food industry is really responding there, not only through the leadership of companies like Happy Family, but now you have big companies like General Mills who are really starting to pay attention too.
Wow. It's sobering and, again, yet hopeful. So it sounds like people are starting to come around. Companies are starting to come around. You said that in schools, it's just, you know, it's just a normal part of the landscape now. But maybe it's not 100%. So how can parents deal with those who really don't get it or don't understand, for instance, at school or even family members, say the in-laws, because they just, this wasn't part of life when they were growing up?
Honestly, I think that's probably one of the biggest challenges with this condition is having someone that's close to you dismiss it or disqualify it or discount it because you realize that your child's life is on the line. And I think it requires extraordinary strength and extraordinary diligence and a lot of patience. And again, the more resources that you can share, the more that, you know, anytime the Today Show or one of these big, you know, CNN or big media group does a hit on food allergies, to share that so that people can realize it's not just you. It's not just your kid. There are literally 17 million people around the country now that are dealing with this. And EpiPen's a $1 billion brand. So, you know, maybe as families we felt we sort of had to keep it in the closet for a while. Mm-hmm. It's coming forward in a really powerful and really beautiful way right now. Again, just referencing the Empire State Building and the way that it was lit up teal to recognize food allergy awareness and the color of food allergies. There's something shifting literally in real time that's acknowledging the full-blown impact of this condition. So it requires extraordinary patience. And, you know, a lot of times that can be with people that are closest to you, like maybe your own mom or your own dad. Mm-hmm. But you have to stay the course. You cannot give up. You have to keep, you know, providing resources, providing videos, providing books so that they can begin to understand that it's not just you. It's not just your kid. And whether that's having them attend something at the preschool or something at the church, I mean, there are ways that you can engage them where they hear it from someone else other than you.
Okay, thank you. So I see that a few questions have come in, and if there's anything that you would like to add, Robin, feel free, and otherwise, is it okay if I go ahead and let you know what our attendees' questions are?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so we have a question that asks, at what age or weight should kids transition from the EpiPen Junior to the regular EpiPen?
You know, that's a great question, and I would direct people to Mylan Pharmaceuticals for those answers. Again, what the EpiPen manufacturers are realizing is that it's going to depend case by case on the child, and one of the struggles that they're seeing now with the EpiPen is that because of the rates of obesity in the United States, that the needle inside the EpiPen can no longer be as uniform where, you know, one injection and one needle, because when you're dealing with obesity issues, sometimes the needle wasn't long enough to get into the child to where it needed to be. So I think that's a very one-on-one conversation that needs to be had with the doctor, and I would also specifically direct people to the EpiPen website for that.
Okay, thank you very much. And along the lines, another EpiPen question here. At what age do you recommend a child to learn how to administer the EpiPen to him or herself?
Again, I think that's going to depend on the child. And again, that's where the resources of online videos are incredibly useful. And I can remember when we first got ours, they told us to practice on an orange. And there are the demo practice sets of EpiPens that you can work with. Again, you know your child best, and what you need to know is that it's fail-safe, that, you know, if that child is out with that thing, that there is someone that can administer that. And so it may not only be teaching the child. You may have to invest a little bit of time to make sure that a teacher or the school nurse or the bus driver or the daycare center worker is well aware and well educated on how to administer the EpiPen. And again, these are the challenges that confront us today as parents, mm-hmm. because the condition has come on so quickly that, you know, people probably haven't necessarily thought through the way you have a CPR training. They're probably at this point, we're ready to have an EpiPen training. And part of CPR should be, you know, learning how to use an EpiPen device.
Okay.
And those are huge opportunities. And it can be scary because you can think, oh, my gosh, these people don't know how to use it, and is my child going to be safe? Yeah, it's scary on the one hand, but the opportunity on the other is huge, and there's an opportunity. And we see organizations and parents and, you know, even teenagers kind of reaching into this where they're saying, okay, I'll develop that video content. I'll show people how to administer mm-hmm. an EpiPen. You know, I'll be able to share that with my school so that my child is safe. And that's the opportunity in front of us because the landscape in front of us is wide open. And because
yeah.
food allergies have come on so quickly, there's a lot of opportunity to create resources and tools that help keep your child safe.
That's wonderful. It sounds like there is, like you said, a lot of opportunity that is out there right now. Are you up for one more question?
Definitely.
Okay. So last but not least, a mom asks, if my child broke out in hives from eating pineapple, should I take her to the allergist for further testing or just avoid pineapple? And she says, my daughter is 5 years old and has not had any other issues with food reactions.
I mean, that's a personal decision. What I've learned is to err on the side of precaution. I think if you have a child that's showing an allergic reaction, it makes a ton of sense to have an allergist that you can call. And if there's an allergic reaction, you can go in and just, you know, get baseline testing, and then you know. Because otherwise you're guessing. And if you go in and you do that, you do the test where, you know, they test across a child's back and you can find out, you know, what they may or may not be sensitive to, especially at the age of 5. They haven't been exposed to everything they might be exposed to yet. Like hazelnut, when my child ingested that for the first time, we had no idea. And I was so glad that we had established that relationship with the allergist and I could call and say, oh, my gosh, we just triggered on hazelnuts. So my advice would be, you know, meet with that allergist. It's going to depend, you know, on the severity of that reaction, how motivated you might be. But, again, the first reaction may be mild. The next one might be more severe. And the unpredictability of the condition is what makes it so dangerous. So, again, the more well-equipped you are and the more armed you are with knowledge and that relationship and that partnership with your allergist, the better off for your child.
Okay, so really it's erring on the side of caution. Truly.
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely.
Okay. Thank you so, so much. This has been amazingly enlightening and I imagine very empowering for our attendees. So you guys have been great. There have been some wonderful questions. We know that Robin's gone over a wealth of terrific information today. So once again, within the next few days, we'll be sending you a follow-up email with a link to the recorded class, along with some resources and Robin's contact information. Once again, a big thank you, a huge, huge thank you to our friends at Happy Family Organic Foods. And, of course, an enormous thank you to you, Robin, for your wonderful expertise. And thank you, everyone, for joining us today.
Thank you. And I do want to leave the listeners with one thing, is to
yes.
remember that underneath any of the sadness or any of the grief or any of the fear that you may initially feel with this diagnosis, underneath all of that is a love that is so powerful that you will create extraordinary change and an extraordinary environment for your child. So once you tap into that, it is such a rocket fuel, and it can accomplish the most extraordinary things.
Thank you for that. It really is all about the love. So have a great day, everybody. Thank you for being here. Thank you, Robin, and we hope to connect with you again soon. Yeah.